a bunch of people in the neighborhood have TV, and I can see the effects on my peers. I warn them, it's gonna create a separation and create a Berlin Wall in the family. It's gonna make my sister become a different kind of person. It's gonna make me become a different kind of person. I'll lose my interest in hockey. I'll get into drugs. I predicted all this when I was 10, but he couldn't understand that. He didn't believe me.
You talk like a heretic.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Contemporary Communications Conference. We're sitting in Venice, California, with Phil Chamberlain, historian of the future, and myself, Jerry Fialka. We're speaking with Bob Dobbs, coming to us discarnately from Toronto. That's Ontario, Canada. Now, we all know that things happened in the 60s that helped change the country, the U.S., and getting the U.S. out of Vietnam, let's say. And was this activism really what caused this change? And discuss that.
Well, of course, the short answer is the whole difference was made by the anti-war movement. Were it not for the outbreak of a pandemic protest, I'm sure that the rolling thunder of that era would have just continued rolling, and who knows if it would have stopped at any such borders as North Vietnam or China, as far as that goes. Anybody else?
Well, I'd add that, of course, without the ground of TV, it wouldn't have had the impact. Is that redundant to point that out?
Well, yeah, good point. I think that ties in with the point that that Richard Nixon at a crucial point of his decision making was confronted on his as I've seen it described, on his desk in the Oval Office. He had a proposal from the military for using the nuclear option in against the North, against the supply lines, the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And at precisely that moment, there was a massive demonstration in the quadrangle, what do you call it, down there in Washington. And that at that time, Nixon went out and talked to the demonstrators, the youth, the flower children, the elderly protesters, the pacifists, and was won over won over at a human level. And I'm not sure how true that story is, whether he was really won over by the populace becoming at home, bringing the war home as a geopolitical element in his front yard, or whether it was some breakthrough of human communication. But on that point of protests striking directly at the perpetrators of the evil, I think it's all too clear that that did happen. And conversely, had it not, well, who can outguess the devil at their worst?
Well, speaking of the devil, I was there in the White House in that period, working for the Secret Council of 10. I wasn't chairman. I was a lower-level operative, but, much higher than the CIA or DIA. And I know that there would not ever have been nuclear war since 1945, because we had it covered well beyond any government positions or even security intelligence positions. And we basically were studying the effects of the belief that Richard Nixon was president of the United States and had some kind of finger on the button. We were studying the effects of that illusion that he held on him and society. So that was basically a controlled experiment.
What was the controlled experiment?
Watching how an American growing up under the effect of radio, Richard Nixon, pre-television, and then having to deal with the effects of television in the 50s and 60s, and then thinking he had assumed a very powerful position and had the power to to trigger off nuclear war. We wanted to see what an American with that sensory profile would do under solar government conditions, which I was part of. And so that whole Vietnam thing was a theatrical play to study him and the various cultures around the world in the response while on and within the ground of television. This is part of my archives, what I have in the Secret Council of 10, the results of those experiments. You have to understand everything disappeared by 1945, and everything after that has been subject to tetrad management, which is our term for the experiment we conducted.
So you considered that a successful play?
Beg your pardon?
So you considered that a successful play?
I think that everything we did, there was open, the results of the experiment were not totally determined by us in the sense that we would learn from it. And the results that those kind of experiments created enabled us to get through the 70s and the 80s and lead to the situation we're in now, where lockdown Bob Rule will be guaranteed and will bring back not only to subgeniuses but to transform pinks.
And what about, maybe you could define a few terms because people might be ignorant of those, that is, briefly define a pink and briefly define the Secret Council of Ten.
Well, a pink is anybody who bugs you, no matter what culture you're from. A subgenius is someone who can live with that problem and maintain personal comfort and tranquility. In other words, live with the problem that pinks are people who bug you, and that they are in the majority and have been for a long time in history. The third point was, the Secret Council of Ten?
Yes.
That is the discarnate administrative group that manages the mixed corporate media and their interactions. Their interactions are the environments they have created through history, the most recent of the last 150 years of the telegraph, movie, automobile, steel, newspapers, radio, television, satellites, and computers. Plus all the chemical, pharmaceutical environments. We manage the interactions of them to maintain some kind of equilibrium. And that situation is a discarnate situation which cannot be localized because you're everywhere at once under electronic conditions, either actively or passively. We are in both situations of active and passive at the Secret Council of Ten. And where we monitor that is best described as, the interzone. William Burroughs tried to define it and allude to it in Naked Lunch. It wasn't a very accurate portrayal of the situation, but he was aware of the situation after World War II as a kind of hijacked planet, and the managers of that situation were in the inner zone. That inner zone is the discarnate zone, the electrical place where we have access to every point in the planet, yet those parts can't see what we're doing. It's invisible. It's a computer. In other words, it's the most powerful networking group.
And who makes up the this council? Yes.
Well, there. To put it simply, there were the traditional nobility and oligarchs from, say, the Gutenberg Galaxy, 1600. One of the strongest forces from that period was the Turn and Taxis family, discussed in, I think it's The Crying of Lot 49 by Thomas Pynchon in that novel. He talks about the intelligence system set up by Turner and Taxis and the new postal services and environment that were created in the 1600s. More recent people would be obviously the oil cartels and the Rockefellers. Then there are the IG Farben networks in Europe who cashed in at the turn of the century on the chemicals revolution. And then there are representatives of various power groups from all parts of the world. It's sort of political power groups. And it gets down to about 40 people. As Captain Beefheart said, there are 40 people in the world and five are hamburgers. These 40 people are controlled by 10, the Secret Council of 10. So each member on the Secret Council of 10 has about four underlings or four representatives that interact with the other 36, so to speak. So that's the Secret Council of 10. And they come out of that historical power group, which Orwell has talked about as Big Brother. Huxley talked about it another way. The occultists talk about it as a great white brotherhood. You know, on and on. As a matter of fact, Stang's book does a good inventory of the different historical names for the power groups that the Secret Council of Ten is made up of.
Bob, could I stop you at that point? I like that analysis. It makes my work a little simpler if I can like put a black box. My black box now says ruling class in it. But I could scrub that, and I could put the Council of Ten with your subdivisions or anybody else's. But what I want to ask you is this. Irrespective of one's analysis and one's intelligence supporting one's analysis of the powers that be, aside, I might add that, of course, Bucky Fuller in his operating manual for Spaceship Earth, he talks at some length about the GPs he capitalizes, the great pirates, right, which fits in.
And he knew they were obsolete. And the Secret Council 10 cannot be called a ruling class. That's an oxymoron in this case, because it's not a class of people. It's individuals who wear huge environments in computer data programs. They don't rule. You can think of Wyndham Lewis's book, The Art of Being Ruled. That's actually the way it is to be a Secret Council of 10 member. When you gauge the effects of your environments on humans and whole societies and cultures in action constantly in a theatrical situation, then it's a very passive role, like a surgeon or a weather forecaster, or, well, let's say an air traffic controller. That might be a more appropriate metaphor. So we're not ruling in a bureaucratic sense. We are ruling in the sense of our pattern recognition and the responses we interpret, how we interpret large-scale patterns of these these technological operations. So you're right. Ruling class is an obsolete term.
Well, okay. You might feel, or I might feel more comfortable liking it to Edward Bellamy's conjectural world of, which is, when he wrote Looking Backward, you know, he had a labor army controlled, you know, that was organized hierarchically. And while something less rigid than that is ambient around the, amongst the workers in the United States, still there is all the same a top-down flow. And at the top, there's this system, let us suppose, to be as you describe. However, I was on my way to...
Just hold that thought. Let me respond about Edward Bellamy. My father knew him. And the structure he laid out at the turn of the century would be the structure that applied up to 1945. Because after that, the visual medium of money, which collapsed in 2930... and the visual medium of newspaper and these top-down agents which created republicanism and the problems and services and disservices of republicanism were obsolesced completely by 45. So Bellamy's analysis would only be accurate up to that point, or his conceptual framework.
Oh, well and good.
All right, so now go on to your next point.
He had other problems. I find it very charming. He talks about the telephone. His man has woken up 100 years in the future, entertained by what, at the time of his writing, 1888, I believe, was a completely mind-blowing concept that you should hear in your living room, say, a concert orchestra, since, you know, this predates the Victrola and the radio.
But only by a few years.
Only by a few years, but it was in that time slot where very cleverly Bellamy could postulate that over the telephone wires, which did exist and were known to his readers, that they had devised a method for transmitting good sound over the telephone. And so he had the effect of what we call radio, but it just went over telephone lines. And I guess that was quite one of the more awesome aspects and charms then of his book, to imagine, conjure the image of hearing a concert, a symphony in your own house.
Right, but every invention comes with a man's thinking. And man is a generic term there. The thought precedes the invention, but what's interesting is that the top subgenius artists predicted the effects of those inventions before they were thought of, or at the same time. So while Bellamy was discussing the possibility of that technical advancement, Flaubert, Mallarmé, Baudelaire, and the Symbolists were developing and giving mirrors of the effect of that new technology on language itself, which was their chosen specialty.
Okay,
so you have two tracks. You have the thought that is anticipating a new environment, and then you have the other thought pattern that is studying the effects of it before the environment show up. So we should include both strains in human history.
Well, good. Then maybe this is a good place. I mean, lest you slip endlessly off into your receding labyrinths of available
pattern recognition.
quite so. I would like to just directly pin you. I mean, here, and this was a major point in the hour video that they, that Jerry sent you of our discussion, which bore on the point that while you bubble over with all this analysis and interesting stuff, it never seems like you get right to what.
Yeah, I'm warning the fish, but how do I help the fish?
Oh, right. That was the metaphor. Right. So to that point, and maybe in, you know, invoking some of your already developed ideas here at this moment, how, I mean, is this Committee of Ten, are they the problem? Should we devise the method for surrounding them, coming in and saying, stick your hands up, you guys are crooks? Or are they not crooks, and are they not likened to a ruling class which might be thought of as appropriate only to be deposed and, you know, as Madame Lafarge might have approved, had off with their heads? In other words, what is to be done, that persistent problem, and or are these people of 10, this Committee of 10, are they our nemesis or are they our benefactor?
They're both. You see, up till the middle 80s, their heads should have been off, and I had to infiltrate, and I was as evil as my colleagues on the council, but I had a strategy to overtake it and shift it. In other words, take over the pink prison and move it into a subgenius kind of resonance. And the celebration of my CDs, Bosmede Ecology, and the new one, Bosmede Ecology 2, or Bosmede Ecology Squared, are a celebration of the fact that I did overtake and become chairman of Secret Council 10. Therefore, those negative aspects you just explained or are familiar with are in abeyance. So my agenda is to make people understand the situation and so that they don't overreact to management and its historical disservices, and understand that the Secret Council 10 has basically no power in that old negative sense anymore. It only has a beneficial power.
And that's what I try to explain. Let me hear that again. Your present relation to the Secret Council of 10?
Is that I control it. That happened in 1988. And I have the help of the civilization from the Booties constellation, which I call the Exus, a term coined by Reverend Stang when he released the Church of the Subgenius, the Book of the Church, Book of Subgenius, whatever it's called, and he called us Exus. So then, since he familiarized that, I use the term Exus, but that's not what they are. They're not called, they don't call themselves the Exus, but I will say they are from the Booties, which Stang did not know. And so we're talking about a universal orgasm here, a universal government lockdown, and then we're moving into mythic stage lockdown. If you look at the charts, I presented my CDs. So these are concepts that aren't explained, or aren't understood, you know, very often among people who've never heard of it.
Yeah, I would have to apologize for not being as thoroughly backgrounded in your present state of development as might be possible. There's a short coming and a limitation of the present discussion, but...
But your responses to the interview were valid, and Jerry did not have the knowledge to sort of explain my positions or my probes in response to your questions and queries. And so I'm willing to continue from your interview because I think I could do a better job responding. Basically, a lot of what I could have said, which would have addressed your question at the end of that interview or in the middle of it, was not brought out in the original interview. It doesn't mean that I haven't thought of it. I think for the beginning of any diagnosis, you know, medicinally speaking, is you have to state the problem and state the solution. And that's what that interview, Entertainment Sucks, does. But I don't get into the applications in that particular interview, but they're implied in my CDs and books like Fatic Communion.
Well, where do you explain your program, or is that not the right way to put it? If you're instrumental in this all-pervasive committee control...
But we're not all-pervasive. See, the images one has, Bucky Fuller was useful. If you read his writings, he gives you an idea of how management's not in control and doing everything backwards. That is necessary. His teachings help you understand what we're really doing. They're not fully explaining how we do it, but we're certainly not a monolithic big brother behind the scenes. The way we do is, you could understand it as the fact that the emperor is in the audience. And what's on the stage? The media themselves, the mixed corporate media, the actors, and humans at this point are only appendages of that. My job is to make people realize they can be more than appendages, and how they've already become more than the appendages of the situation, of the mixed corporate media. But in doing that, we're like pollsters in audience research. We're in the audience studying the effects of the operation that we don't fully control in the old sense.
Well,
so like the trial of commission and that are fictions. They're not anywhere near what's really going on. And that's not what, so it's not appropriate to project any of those kind of a ominous secret top-down bureaucracies on the image of the Secret Council 10. That's not what the Secret Council 10 is. Secret Council 10 is like the seat of consciousness in the brain.
Why is it misnamed secret?
That's to get attention. And it is secret in terms of how it operates.
And who are the other nine?
Well, the only ones I mention are a man named Romanov in the former Soviet Union, a Russian, who is the man behind Gorbachev. Another person is
that as in Romanov dynasty?
Yeah, no. He has the same name, but he wasn't part of the dynasty. It's just a coincidence. But the other member was Prince Dernan Taxis, who died a year or two ago. I understand there's an article on his widow in the December issue of Vanity Fair. You can see what she's doing to his estate. And the other person I ran against was Prince Charles. Now, it's interesting that Dernan Taxis went down first when I began to lock down Bob Rule in 1990. He died. Gorby was out in 91, and Prince Charles was out in 92. So, the Secret Council 10 is imploding into just operating with me and Connie.
Well, would it be up to expanding its membership?
Yes, that's my whole agenda. And membership in the Secret Council 10 is understanding of what it does. So I in my CD, in the first booklet, I outline the 10 what we call holy offices that one should study and work with and interface all of them. And that leads to the pattern recognition that understands the function of Secret Council 10. And then that frees you up to take over my job.
Well, we're on parallel paths. We may have parallel visions. It's that I would see I'm not trying to state this in a competitive way with what you're involved in, but there is the vision that I am in grasp of at this point in my life is that a desirable situation on planet would be where the 5 billion adults, the all-inclusive. I work with the idea of the inclusivity of the entire membership of the planet. Like there are no outsiders in the unanimity of the planet. The five words: the world, the planet, the earth, and the geosphere, and all form the democrosphere.
Yes. You're exactly right. I agree with that.
The world democro-Sylvania, and that this is the database for referentially asserting the dictates of the democratic totality. It is a consciously contrived totality, totalistic, you know, as opposed to totalitarian. But I do think in terms of the dictatorship of the unanimity. If we could ascertain by electronic poll or by psychic method or political science devices of whatever sort what the universal 5 billion wide plenary wills and wants and druthers were of the planet's population, I should say that we had something likened to a godlike or binding law. So I see that as GOD, the guidance of Democro-Sylvania. Ideas like you would like to see?
Well, what you described, I guess, might be familiar to some listeners as Teilhard de Chardin's New Sphere. Noosphere, I think, and it's almost like news, N-E-W, the New Sphere. We're all involved in the news electrically. And what you describe as that coalition of wills is what we use as a principle in the Secret Council 10. You just described the last 5 minutes what we do. We respond and modulate and work with that democrosphere. What did you call it, democrosphere?
Democrosphere, or for the city of man, Democro-Sylvania.
Yeah. In other words, it's mass man, and we have extended, we have created a body of Christ, to use the Christian metaphor, electrically. We've extended the central nervous system, which we but the people are all one in sleep. We all speak the same language when we're sleeping. And we've externalized that biological fact electrically, and that's what you just described.
But let me interject just briefly, and that is, Bob, what are you trying to accomplish? I understand somewhat what you're trying to accomplish, and I understand, Phil, what you're trying to accomplish, but what we're trying to do on this agenda in this communication conference is talk about how, what type of action we can take to accomplish this. Now, I understand that people can read your liner notes or hear your CDs, but not everyone can. And with you, Phil, the same. How are you going to get your message out and actually change things? It goes back to my original question, is that 60s activism caused a change, and it was going to continue on the agenda, that is, and say, how can we accomplish some sort of change today? What kind of activism is going to accomplish the change that happened in the 60s?
Well, what happened in the 60s mirrored the return of the original separateness of consciousness called Rai, return to the plane of essence. So we have we were unified and reached the state that Phil was talking about in the 60s on the occult sphere, on the inner plane. This is channeled through Cosmic Awareness and Dave Worster. But I'm not here to propagate any more changes, because all possible changes that we could imagine, if we wanted to specialize in particular time zones, in the future are already here and are already happening. So we don't want to have a linear view of change. I would say the job is to understand how we got to this situation, how we got to the utopian situation we're in. It's not strictly utopian, but that might be a proper way of saying it. So I think that my CDs and my books are the best explanation and celebration of how we got to that point. But since we already are at that point, then my communications are irrelevant. There are no more changes necessary.
Well, okay, I guess there's a structural problem in this conversation, in that maybe most of us here aren't adequately versed in what the content is that you refer to of your works.
Right, but it's not that necessary, because you just gave a description of something that I would agree with if we're trying to match here and agree. I don't think we should try to agree. I agree with Marshall McLuhan when he said, in this time under electric conditions, the goal is not to communicate, not to match, but to make our own spaces with a sensitivity to the space-making of every other entity.
Oh, okay, but I detected a trend that when I detected it in others, it causes me to counsel them on the need to look to the future. I'm strong on teleology.
Yes.
I think of myself as a...
Bucky Fuller wrote about that.
Well, sure, with his anticipatory design science.
Yes.
And precisely to the point, I'm saying, while you, on the other hand, are saying, well, you know, it's cool, you know, very zen. I mean, you know, we are the bodhisattva if we realize it.
No, I don't. I know what you mean, but as a probe, I would correct the images. I don't think any anthropomorphic cultural human images of spirituality or anything are appropriate to the situation we're doing. And that's maybe my work, is trying to sculpture the image that we might be able to refer to, but it's an impossible task. For example, I would use as a precedent or an antecedent the Finnegan's Wake. Now, who the heck understands Finnegan's Wake besides us in Secret Council 10? So it's an ongoing process. It may take thousands of years to carve out this image.
But I guess here's what unnerves me of your analysis. When you get to the point of sitting quietly doing nothing...
No, you can't do nothing.
It's Jerry's point, you know, just at the level... and then you say, you know, linear action is not necessary, but, you know, there are concepts of processual change.
Yeah, visual space. I'm not saying linear action is not relevant. It is one of the sensory modalities, and it's been extended. We call it the Gutenberg galaxy, and that's a fact of a new man-made nature that we have to take into account. So it's almost like what Frank Zappa said in his recent interview. He talked about the constant of time, but the mutation of space, to put it in simple terms. Maybe you remember that, Jerry?
Yes.
Page 64 of the Qatar magazine interview.
Okay.
Talked about the two factors, the constant time, where everything, all time is happening at once, but it has to interface with the element of space, which is mutating waveform, which is like every moment as we perceive it, as we perceive it linearly. So you get these two factors.
Well, I'm sure you read the United States newspapers, and we are acquiring a new president over here as an attempt at humor.
Yeah.
I'd be interested in your take on that presidential change, and what in terms of the way you look at the world does it foretoken?
And before you go into that, we could remind our listeners that Bob indeed predicted that George Bush would win.
Yes, I did.
Okay.
And I was right. He did win. You just need to read Pete Bruton's book, The Mafia, the CIA, and George Bush. That explains the bailout that was necessary by George Bush as certain pink factions siphoned off the visual space mythic stage of money for their world government purposes, and they had to do that through the SNL scandal, and of course that has left the problem, the mythical debt, in the lap of the American citizens. And so he has to bring in somebody to take care of that problem. So his goal was to get out of the White House to operate with the benefits of what they siphoned off on a global scale. You see what I'm saying? So Bill Clinton matched the image that they knew the people desired, which was basically that the New World Order was moving too fast, and we needed the Americans needed a comforting image to bring back a domestic familiarity and sense of concern about the effects of the lockdown of Bob Rule manifested in the United States as George Bush's New World Order, which is only a puny fragment of the tetrad management. I mean, the election in the United States is very puny compared to the operations I have to deal with. But it is something we have to do, so I welcome talking about it. But in simple terms, what we have, according to my chart, is the mythic government lockdown from 1977 to 1990, which, for a familiar image, would be the software communism of the entertainment industries, the biggest concern of profit, growing concern of profit today. That is the mythic stage lockdown, happened between 1977 and 1990. But when Bob Rule lockdown obsolesces that from 1990 to 2020, then according to my chart, you have to have a warfare among the parts of the previous lockdown process, which was the mythic government lockdown. So mythic government lockdown, software communism, or what I call manipulative tactility, has found the appropriate image in Slick Willie, and it's basically an operation from your town there, L.A., the Hollywood showbiz conglomerate, the entertainment complex, grabbing the functions of bureaucracy, of democratic bureaucracy, bureaucratic visual space, and newspaper republicanism. Because they are now obsolete, the mythic government, they have to lock down that old obsolete apparatus of government to assure and have a feeling that they're going to be viable. So it's a massive identity crisis by Hollywood to make sure that Bill Clinton got in, and they think they're kicking George Bush out. But Bush welcomed that because he had larger agendas to work on the whole planet.
I understand that somewhat, Bob. I have to remind you, L.A. is not our town. We live in Venice, California.
That's right. I know you guys are the guerrilla front against it.
But what do you predict is going to happen with Clinton?
Oh, Bill Clinton? It's going to be a disaster for about 2 years until he recognizes what Germany's going to do. The basic premise for manipulating, which George Bush is aware of it, the basic premise for manipulating visual space, which is the money market, the money medium, within the post-money market world of software communism, is that the orbiting economy cannot be trapped anymore. It's called flight capital. You can't trap in the old sense of the Marxist dialectic of history or anything that objected to the rule of bankers or visual space or monopolies, the ruling class. This thing, this medium of the ruling class in visual space terms, is just orbiting the planet and cannot be trapped. So the best way to deal with that, they got away, they've escaped the coup, is to be as nice and kind as possible to them and allow them to be as taxed as little as possible. So what will happen, Clinton will probably bring in his old Fabian socialist program, representing Canada by Trudeau, and will try to implement his political obligations in that framework. the liberal democratic framework, or Democratic Party framework. It will fail miserably. Meanwhile, Germany will move ahead and realize to adopt this new policy of no taxes on the high-end income earners, and that will create a remarkable recovery in Germany. The United States, by 95, will follow that. Clinton will be forced to repudiate that. I think maybe his advisors already partly know that, so they're creating the image that he's a conservative Democrat. But after that, then Canada will revive, and we're going to move into a very new renaissance once the world managers and the national government leaders realize this is what they have to do, that you can't capture that ruling class anymore. And it's not an advantage to be the ruling class. They have a lot of sweat and work to keep the visual space medium going. It's us citizens who have the slack of part-time employment and entertainment consumption or whatever we want to do. We don't have to deal with that level of management. The rich person, the old pink warden, is a harassed bureaucrat now. So let them, let the suckers who want to be part of that mythic stage gravitate toward that and have those illusions that they're operating and running amok on the global campus theater. So,
but it comes down to a point.
I see that as a result of that awareness by 95, plus fusion energy coming in, we're going to have in 25 years the utopia that has been prophesied by me and all my prophetic antecedents.
Well, it comes down to a point where citizens' intelligence, which is a term I first read in Walter Boart's book, Operation Mind Control, and I consider this just a general awareness.
Yes.
You know, the common man's involvement. We don't live in a direct democracy, but we're trying really hard to let the ruling class know what we want, because they've led us to believe that this is a democracy and that
our
point of view can make
misguided.
Pardon me?
That's misguided. Those terms. You see, the electric environment we live in, the software communism, is the most democratic environment that ever existed. In terms of how, like Finnegan's Wake, the author writes a book and he leaves half of it out so that the reader can participate in the making of the meaning of the book. We experience that daily with the television medium. It's a making medium. So the environment we live in is the most democratic that you could ever imagine, but the term democracy refers to the visual space bureaucracy that came out of parliaments and the British feudal period, so which was enhanced by the printing press and the newspaper. That particular mythic stage of democracy is not a relevant factor for inducing democracy. It is only engaged in its own identity crisis to maintain its sense of its mythic stage and its past. So we can't use the term democracy. We can't worry about 19th century ideas of democracy. They don't apply today. They do apply for those people who want to engage in that Hollywood movie set or hologram like Bill Clinton is doing, but it has no effect on you and I as citizens, because we are discarnate and we wear all these environments, all this historical technological baggage we're all wearing as kings and slaves at the same time. So when we recognize the proper terminology, which is what I suggest in Entertainment Sucks, then we can then jump from that matching technical jargon into free awareness, which is slack.
But, well, okay, you omit one little troublesome subject in my analysis. There are evil men doing horrendous things on planet. There are pandemic starvations. There are spreading infections without antidotes. And there's a population curve that's off the wall.
Yes.
Yet, you know, you, along with the fellow from the Hudson Institute, whom I'm thinking of, are predicting good things for the planet in 20 years.
Yes.
How do
we get there?
How do we get the crooks out of high places? Whatever their telegenicity, whatever their mediaicity, you know, and irrespective of what analysis you use, the decision makers seem to be interested in perpetrating horror shows around the planet, in linear terms, perpetrating colonialisms and imperialisms, and in ancient archetypal terms, just ripping off the planet as they have been. That is still going on apace. The population problem is coming to a consummation. Chaos. Cultural, social chaos, a great sundering and a great cosmic shaking of the earth, a great tembler, geopolitical tembler can be predicted for 20 years from now. Yet your view is somewhat to the opposite now.
Yeah. Well, as I've expressed, I would say that heaven and hell are simultaneously at hand. We are in a situation where the pink prison is burning down and it's burning the whole planet, and not everybody is going to survive the ending of that fire, the putting it out. Part of my agenda is to explain how the fire started and one way of putting it out, but you're yet.
Well, right, who is the everybody that survives and who is the others that don't? That seems to be a key question here. Who is in the lifeboat?
That's right. Well, that's for you to continually to be paranoid about whether you're in it or not.
Well, that it's interesting you say that, Bob, because when I use this expression to describe myself as historian of the future, it's only partly correct since the history, you know, it's a stretch in the term, but
yes.
So it's actually more correct to say I'm working on a historical novel of the future.
Autopsical archive?
Say it again?
Autopsical archive, in the sense of autopsy?
Oh.
Are you doing an autopsy of the future?
Oh, well, I would see it more as a prescription, a treatment, and a healing.
Yes.
In the future.
But we don't know what actions are correct. We don't have any standards. So
no.
We assume that there's, you know, the chaos.
Well, don't include everybody when you say we don't know. There are some pockets of.
Did you say you include everybody?
No, I am admonishing you to not, when you use the phrase we don't know what to do. I may not know what to do either, and you may ultimately be correct.
I know what to do, but I'm also in the audience. I know how to manage that part of myself that doesn't know
right.
with the part of myself that does know.
I see. I think we need a conference of 5 billion people, but I have never figured out how to patch it.
Well, that's already happening.
Well, of
course. That CNN is the latest development of that, but it's been happening since we've had satellite communications for 20 years, and no part of the planet is immune or not having access to any electric form of communication, radio, TV, whatever, or telephones. That is the conference.
But can individuals, do they have the choice whether to be active and that will result in them living or dying?
Yes, they have the choice to find out the determination of that choice, the effects of it, but often they don't learn fast enough. You see, but my work is also a warning that you better start learning the correct agendas in the autopsical archives to help you speed up and have a chance of surviving. So if we're going to become co-gods, co-creators with the original creator, capital C creator, then it's not the Stang version of Slack where you just assume everything's going to roll over you. Not that he says that, but that's the popular interpretation of his book. Slack is not happiness. Slack is hard work. But people don't know what to work at today. So I give them a guideline what to work at, as well as giving them the slack to hallucinate any other things they think they should do.
Now, where do we find your best clear statement of what's to be worked at?
I'd say the liner notes in the CD, but they need to be, that's like an outline, the CD liner notes. It's a very dense essay, but it's an outline. The complement to that would be my book, Fatic Communion, with Bob Dobbs. That gives a debate dialogue slash, you know, debate slash dialogue with the archetypal, most controversial and brilliant schools of thought that we have up to this point. It's a dialogue debate among them. If you learn to deal with those different schools of thought, then that gives you the agility conceptually and hopefully perceptually, which is more important today. And I emphasize the percept in my CDs. The book is more conceptual since print is a conceptual evoking medium. But you deal with that. Now, I'm also saying that, of course, my puny little gestures won't save people in a huge level, but I also am confident in saying that the work that I do in the Secret Council 10 is taking care of a lot of people behind the scenes in a form of complex clairvoyance. So that is hard to talk about, and most people wouldn't have access, but I think part of the Stang's effort to turn me into a god as a church leader, someone to be worshipped or to be appreciated and to have faith in, is a healthy notion to put out because I'm trying to help people understand that I'm doing something that's going to get most of them through the problem faster than they realize.
But often people feel alienated by your ego and your megalomaniacal approach.
Yeah, because I have to use words when I talk to them, and words will evoke that. But I'm certainly not egomaniacal. I couldn't do the work I did if I was megalomaniacal. Like, what I'm saying is such a small part of what I do as a mixed corporate media tetrad manager that to use language is futile. But I'm willing to use language for those subgeniuses that can see through that, see through that this guy's not an egomaniac. He's trying to offer a pattern for me. But, of course, people will project that because they've been conditioned by the pinks for so long and they have their own projections to deal with. That's a risk I have to take. It's not even a problem. It's actually fun to have people think that.
Well, you know, I recognize and appreciate in your work the fact that you fit in this pattern. I have a matrix on my wall which shows it shows the steps that must be gone through by various notions of entering into the future. Everything from building a utopist community and wishing it would expand around the world to launching an anarchist scheme and see that expand politically to the parousias of Christendom going through various stages leading in the future to some kind of political science-derived world order models project type entry into a future preferred utopia, as that project calls it, and on and on. You can look at any individual that's taken us on a time ship into the future. So I recognize that you're on that matrix somewhere. I want to get a little more familiar with some of your prescriptive elements. And
see where I fit on the chart.
And precisely. See what your stages are that you see planet going through and what the individual metanoias must be to create what I think of as a global metanoia.
Yes.
And I see a re-spiritualization of our planet. I see it coming into, I see it coming into an organicity, particularly a psychic organicity. I mean, so back to Teilhard, perhaps, but I don't see it in a Christian light, but I see that once we get beyond the Sturm und Drang of this military history since the collapse into agriculture and beyond that we're now suffering from, if we can restore the archaic mode where we didn't need to be violent, well, in that, our minds will get better in tune, our bodies and our lifestyles, the Buddha will be happy, even the Christians will think Christ has come back to earth, all will end well, and the story of the human saga will have a happy ending.
Yes.
Or at least a happy middle.
I have no problem with that, but it's how much you identify with those words, and when do we arrive at that point? Because if, let's say we arrived at that situation 100 years ago, and we believe that one can reincarnate when they die, so we have many souls who are in a sort of a heavenly state when they're dead, in a slack-filled state, the astral plane, say, and they used to have the earth plane as a place to focus pain as an artifact to differentiate from the astral heaven they were in. We now have created a heavenly utopia almost in many ways, so that the soul, when he dies, goes to the astral plane, and then he sees he can't solve that ultimate problem of what to do with the cosmic boredom by going to a prison. So we really, probably souls traditionally haven't been able to deal with that, so they create an artificial, a tiny, smaller problem. And maybe that's where the Gnostic vision is accurate, that they created denser forms of vibration and created matter in the earth plane so they could get into like a small prison and act out a limited problem, a smaller problem compared to the cosmic problem of consciousness itself, and where did it come from, and what is it? So, but through history, this role of the earth plane has been sabotaged by the incipient utopia that Phil talked about. So when the person dies, he goes to the astral plane and sees that he can't find an area for a puny problem and create a puny, tiny conflict that he can attempt to solve as an antidote to the unsolvable mystery of cosmic consciousness. We have now maybe the 20th century's most violent century because all these souls are reincarnating, and most of the souls that ever lived are on the planet now, 5 billion. They are in a century where they are creating torture to each other as a resolution of this dilemma that utopia is imminent in the physical plane, so they're reincarnating violently as a joke. So maybe we don't know what a utopia condition is. So we wouldn't know where, if we got there in Phil's terms. That's a question, if you believe in reincarnation, that has to be applied.
Well, listen, I may be one jump ahead of you on that score, that is, as to the definitional relation of utopia. And it's like a chiseling away of something that exists to expose the image within the sculpture. It's simply this: I want to make it in a lasting way that you'll never be able to shake this thought. But
yeah.
Operationally, what needs to be done on Earth is to subdue and dismantle realpolitik, the rule by military nation states, and implement the world rule of law through negotiated settlement and through orderly procedures between nations, which aren't dependent upon power politics as we've known it since the decline of humanity into the agricultural industrial history, and to reinstitute the emotional sets that were ambient in the antiquity preceding, back in the Ice Age is far enough back, but up to the Old Stone Age and into the Mesolithic, the early New Stone Age, the Mesolithic Age, up in those points, the areas that Rion Eisler talks about as having lived for thousands of years without walled city-states, without soldier burials, without iconography depicting the vast letting of blood, and with no pictures of men wielding clubs and bows and arrows. That order is a capability of the human, and to bring it about on the earth it requires going through a wall, the iron wall of militarism, and the definition of removing it is to close down the Pentagon, close down the Kremlins of the world, and to institute the world rule of law as is talked about and well understood within the councils of international lawyers and international relations experts, etc., and which is definitely the legislative arm of utopist thought. And that, then, I think, is a good working definition of what is to be done to improve the world. That is, you demilitarize it, you create the civilocracy, the rule by civilians. We call this a civilization, but its singular characteristic has been its militarization ever since the advent of agriculture and the armed force to defend the store of grain against such others as or suffered crop failure and came to get ours. So it's really quite simple at that level. It's an entirely negative thing. You take away the military and its five constituents, which are military politicians, the patriotic organizations like the VFW, the military intellectuals like at RAND and in the colleges, and then the industrial branch that reaps all the money profit, and the uniformed soldiers. Those five categories are on planet a negligible amount of people in each country. There are only a few million out of hundreds of million. In this country, there are only a few million people. And in a population of 5 billion, they're statistically a blip. So that if we do get this thing I'm talking about the will of the 5 billion people, you can rest assured they'll be overwhelmingly in favor of getting rid of this parasitic, this brown, this khaki-colored cancer, this olive drab virus, you know, that has affected us since the advent of so-called civilization. And anyway, for starters, that's where I would counsel a young person to go: be a peacenik.
Right now,
Bob, can I just?
Let me just respond to that thought.
Okay.
Because that's very important what he says. The subgenius yearns to get to that post-militaristic situation, and I'm saying that to make that bridge, needs to have the understanding that the militarized situation has been obsolete since 45 anyways, maybe earlier, that the new militarization is the militarization of the human spirit by Madison Avenue and by software and the entertainment complex. Now, that forces the old military hardware people to be paranoid and on the fringe. Therefore, they overreact. And so part of the jujitsu of making the bridge to this new point that Phil eloquently explained is to stop making the militarization's obsolescence to feel paranoid, and that might require a temporary software fast of the new invasive software world to make them relax so they don't keep reacting, which they've been doing since 1945 with those pink secret societies and the militaristic level that Phil just said. And so then if we did that, we then may have an understanding created through the 5 billion souls, 5 billion entities on the planet, the 5 billion civilians, of how to turn back the software environment and dismantle the military. So that's mainly what I'm saying, is that Bob's agenda is to include this little piece of data as part of the jigsaw puzzle to create that pattern recognition that will make the leap. You see what I'm saying, Phil? I think that's clear what I said.
Yeah, that sounds good to me. I might quibble at the thought that it'd be a little bit of data, but because to me it's like a gene, which might carry a major characteristic.
Right. It is, I think it is a major characteristic. I was just being modest.
Right.
But it has to be articulated before people can see what you're requesting, because many people see what you're requesting. They see the obsolescence of that, but they don't know how to go from here to there. You know, we're in a situation where the old militarized civilization situation archetype is dead, but we can't get into the new situation. It's powerless to be born.
Well, never say can't. There is a way.
And I'm saying that part of my explanation is part of the necessary information that needs to be included in seeing the way.
Absolutely. 5 billion people are players in this game.
Yes.
This concludes part one of the first Contemporary Communications Conference with Bob Dobbs, Philip Chamberlain, and myself, Jerry Fielka.